Hitler, a Jew was a Jew. It made no difference whether he was Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, or Atheist. He was a Jew. At Auschwitz and Majdanek, a Jew was a Jew and a potential corpse. To most outsiders, all members of a people belong to that community and show basically the same traits and attitudes. To the insider, all members of his community are somehow bound together, though he recognizes that they show a great diversity in attitude and approach to the major problems of the day. Take a congregation such as ours, a selected group within a particular Jewish community, selected by social and economic criteria, as well as by religious preference. Even so, there are significant differences among us. We vote differently. We have different opinions on social and cultural issues. We raise our families in different ways. And we are only one of perhaps two dozen similarly selected congregations in our city, each of which has its own pattern of worship and behavior and similar personal differences. And beyond this, of course, nearly 40% of the Cleveland Jewish community does not belong to any synagogue. Because of the frequent and related differences of opinion among us, it's sometimes difficult to remind ourselves that we are one, a people. We are treated as one, however, in the eyes of the world, and we act as one in certain ways, particularly in the support of Israel and of many of our local institutions. We are one, a people, because we share a past, because of the pressures of the outside world, because of cultural traditions, and of course, because of our faith. Now, there have always been great debates in Jewish life. Zionist versus non-Zionist, secular versus religious, religious traditionalist versus religious liberals. These great debates were argued passionately, and in time, some of them were resolved by time. The anti-Zionist debate was resolved in 1948. Now, religious debates, as distinguished from almost any other kind, are never settled. No debate was more acrimonious, or more hotly contested than the religious debates of the past, between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, between the Karaites and the Rabbinites, between the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim, and over the last two centuries, between religious liberals and religious traditionalists. Now, you cannot convince another of positions which he believes runs counter to his faith. All you can do is hope that debate will not get out of hand and wise heads will maintain a sense of transcending unity and recognize the overriding need to be civil. A religious position is not debatable, but one can at least follow the philosophy of live and let live. Unfortunately, in the last 10 years or so, groups have come into being in Jewish life which do not accept this position. In Israel, the chief rabbinate and the minions who staff their bureaucracy have set for themselves a task of turning the state into a Jewish state, that is, into a Talmudic Jewish state. They not only control the laws of personal status, as they have since the beginning of the state, it is now a matter of issue among them to discuss the ways in which non-Orthodox rabbis can be made irrelevant to Israeli life and to their work, and their work everywhere hampered. They do this in many ways. They deny non-Orthodox rabbis the right to conduct marriages and funerals. They return year after year to the wording of the law of return as it deals with converts. Chief Rabbinate would like to add a single word to that law, kahalacha, according to the law, the rabbinic law. And he would like to add it because it would allow anyone who was a convert to be denied admission if the conversion was by other than Orthodox means. Now the law reads that one who may come in and automatically be a citizen if he's born of a Jewish mother or is a convert. The key phrase, kahalacha, is missing. Now the issue is not simply the issue of Orthodox law, but that the amended law would rule out any Jew converted by a non-Orthodox rabbi. It's part of a program to delegitimize the non-Orthodox rabbinate. How do we know this? A group of rabbis in Denver, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, met regularly. They decided to deal with this problem. Each one would conduct conversions according to the full letter of the law, even to the taking of a drop of blood. This was a noble effort at accommodation, but a failure. The Orthodox rabbinate in Israel insisted that the conversion certificate for any Jew who has intentions of settling in Israel must be signed by one or two of the Orthodox rabbis of the town. It is not the form that counts, therefore, but who carries out that form. Many rabbis have since received inquiries from potential converts as to their status if they go to Israel. They can only be told that it is iffy. Perhaps some say they ought to arrange for an Orthodox marriage in order to make sure that this option is open to them if they need it. The degree to which political machinations enter this area was shown in bold relief last spring when Shimon Peres and Moshe Shamir debated, as you recall, the advisability of an international peace conference. Mr. Shamir was eager to stop Mr. Peres's bid for the Knesset to the cabinet to pass a law which would agree to that conference. And he spent a good bit of time barnstorming around the capitals of the world. Shamir was quick while he was away to strike a bargain with the religious parties. He would guarantee that their desired revision of the law return would be brought to a vote in the summer session of the Knesset if they would vote with him against the conference. Shamir, you recall, was able to block Peres, and he did bring up the law, but they couldn't enough gather sufficient votes for the revision. It fell through by just three votes. Three votes given by the Arab members of the Knesset. I'm sure that the Orthodox rabbinate will find a way to bring this up again sometime in the near future. This is only the most recent of a series of measures which the official religious bodies have tried, through which the official religious bodies have tried to browbeat the Knesset into passing as law, so they can safely complete their control of the religious life of Israel. They see themselves as the state church. The political maneuvers of the religious blocs in Israel are well known. In the early years, they insisted on getting money for yeshivot, draft exemption for yeshiva students, and curricular control of their schools. In later years, the issues have become less limited and more demanding. They have involved the banning of certain kinds of autopsies and abortions, and also they've involved the use by the members of the National Religious Party who are in the government of rights which run counter to the will of the secular parties. The religious functionary, for instance, who heads the Department of Interior, refuses to release to France a convicted man, a religious Jew, who has been tried and convicted and sentenced, awaits him there. The religious bloc in Israel consists of several groups. First, the religious authorities themselves. Also, the Haredim, the black-suited ones, the strict ones. Members of small groups which are fundamentally confrontational and fundamentalistic. The Jews who make the lives of archaeologists difficult, claiming always that they dig where there are Jewish graves, the Jews who shout to close cinemas and restaurants open on the Sabbath. Add to these the Gush Emunim, the traditionalist and Orthodox pioneers who have settled on the West Bank. There are many reasons for the Gush, but certainly one of them, some of their leaders have been Orthodox rabbis, and certainly part of the appeal of the Gush, of the settlement of the West Bank, has been the fact that the West Bank is precisely the area that, according to the Torah, was commanded to Moses as an eternal possession. Then there are the majority in Israel today who are traditionalists, usually Sephardim. These men do not necessarily approve of every act of the Orthodox religious parties, but they agree that the Jewish state must in fact be Jewish in terms that they understand. When the State of Israel was founded in 1948, the vision was of a socialist Israel with a slight religious tint to it. A typical citizen of the state was a European Jew The more traditional group, the Eastern European Jews, made their entrance in numbers somewhat later. Over the years, the composition of the state has changed radically. The Yerida, those who left, those who have gone down, those who have come to America and Canada and the like, have been mostly European Jews. The high rate of family formation has been mostly among Jews from Oriental countries, families who have never known anything but traditional forms. So today, a majority of Israel believes that the state should be a Jewish state. There's no particular problem with many of the issues that the Orthodox establishment espouses. Now, what has this to do with our topic, the changing Jew? It raises a fact of Jewish life, which is in some degree or other affects Jews throughout the world. Like it or not, Talmudic, that is, Rabbinic Judaism, is playing a much more important role in our contemporary lives than heretofore. Now, this is not all a loss. Talmudic Judaism, after all, represents 1,500 years of high culture, much that is good and valid. In part, it offers us a basis for more color and emotion in our lives. And Israel today is contrasted to the Israel of 1948. The majority of Jews prefer some form of traditionalism. And I'm using traditionalism in opposition to orthodoxy, not because they are necessarily opposites, but because they represent different approaches. The traditionalists, the majority in Israel, are not united as a group. The Orthodox are. The Orthodox have a definite agenda. The traditionalists do not. They simply want the state to have a familiar Jewish flavor to it. Given these facts, traditionalism is the emotional framework of much that happens in present-day Israel. The traditionalists are the body which gives the religious authorities the backing that they need, even when the traditionalists do not seem to agree with the authorities' actions. In Israel, the non-traditionalist Jew has barely replicated himself, 2.4 children per family, while the more traditional Jew often has 4 children, and the more Orthodox, 6, 8, or more. The traditional Jew is a member of the Eastern Aliyah, which now numbers over 50% of the population. More Jews in Israel today are traditionalists, rather than holding the old socialist liberal position of the early founders. Israel is not, and presumably never was, a state of anti-religious free thinkers, though it has had its share. But the early vision was a graceful and urbane future, largely free of religious restraints. At the very conception of Israel, David Ben-Gurion made an agreement with the Orthodox which gave them control of the rights of personal status, marriage, divorce, inheritance, and the like. He did so that he had no political reason to do so, because he recognized that the old yeshuv, the older settlers, need to feel the state was Jewish in essence. He also felt it advisable to continue the laws of the British Mandate, which granted to each religious community control over the laws of personal status within their communities. He thought this would be enough. In the first 10 years, religious bloc with 6 to 8, 10 votes out of 120 in the Knesset went along, demanding only incremental benefits, more money for yeshivot and the like. Ben-Gurion called his policy the status quo principle. It proved to be anything but. As the demography of the state changed, as the composition of the citizens changed, the politics of the state changed, the socialist anti-religious bloc diminished in importance, and the Orthodox and traditionalists gained immensely. Now you have the kind of religious political machine never dreamed of in David Ben-Gurion's day. All Israeli are not Haredim. Many who are traditionalists in Israel are not sympathetic with the religious parties in their movement to delegitimize non-Orthodox Jews. They vote not with the religious parties, but with Likud or Labor or some other party. The religious bloc gains only 10 seats in the Knesset, 10 out of 120. But the truth is, the basic framework of life in Israel is increasingly rabbinic, and in all likelihood, it will continue to be so. One of the unexpected byproducts that occurred with the establishment of the state was the state's religious life had an impact on religious life in the diaspora. For the first time, diaspora Jewry was heavily pressured to conform to a set of rules established by another Jewish community, that of Israel. Israel was just saying that it had the right to determine who is a Jew, to define the nature of Jewish identity, and to impose these upon the diaspora, and many of the in the diaspora felt that they had to conform. Vide the experiment in Denver and other such. How does this occur? By requiring, for instance, that a conversion be according to rabbinic law, which means a drop of blood must be taken for the man, from the man, immersion in the pool, and so on. Anything less is not accepted. I've mentioned previously the community in Denver, which tried to work out an agreement among all groups that they would follow these laws. They did, and yet it didn't work. Why not? Because the Orthodox insisted that only the signatures of the three Orthodox rabbis of the town were valid and would count. How does this occur? By requiring, for instance, a divorce be accompanied by a get. This too has been agreed on by a number of the non-Orthodox rabbis. The fact is that the get is recognized only when it is developed and signed by Orthodox rabbis. Without a recognized get, the Orthodox community will not permit remarriage. If remarriage has taken place and there are children, the children are called mamzerim and cannot ever, ever marry a kosher Jew. Israel's religious norms have had an impact on diaspora and on religious life. There are, of course, traditional separatist communities, such as Williamsburg, which are American versions of the Dura Carta. Recently, there have been attempts to have certain groups among the Orthodox to separate the Orthodox community from the rest for membership in such bodies as the Synagogue Council of America. Most rabbis of the Orthodox community refuse to invite Reform or conservative scholars into their congregations, lest they disseminate falsehood and misinformation. On the other hand, the Orthodox Jewish community in America is now politically of age. Its leaders are able to assert its desires quite forcefully, quite openly, and do so. There are Orthodox leaders who are cooperating with Reform and conservative leaders. They live by their own rules, but in all other things, feel themselves members of the United American Jewish community. Now, what has all this to do with a changing Jew? In America, in the first half of the century, the Americanization of the Jew, the liberalization of the Jew, reform, was the backdrop of what people's thinking was taken for granted. Reform congregations were the dominant congregations. Conservative congregations were seen as on the way to reform, to Americanization. It was believed that even the Orthodox congregations would travel that way in short order. Now, in the last half of the century, particularly since the Second World War, it has become increasingly clear that even among Reform congregations, there was a return to ritual and tradition of some proportion, a return, some would say, to basic Jewish values. This has occurred for many reasons. The children and grandchildren of the Eastern European immigrants came to their own and were more traditional in their attitudes. There's a growing appetite for ethnicity and color in the American community as a whole. There was a sobering impact of the Holocaust and the glorious impact of Israel. One result of all of this changed mood was a vague but pervasive feeling among Jews that Orthodox Judaism was a standard. American Jews were not rushing to be Orthodox, although a small number were. But many of them were prepared to say that if they were more religious, they would be more traditional. Do you remember how such people delighted in singing tradition, tradition? Across the board, today's American Jews have a more traditional bent than his parents. He is also less religiously educated, and he defines religion largely as ritual, as what happens in the synagogue, rather than a complete and all-embracing theory of life. He has no trouble when he goes to the synagogue finding there a renewal of forms and of rituals. The synagogue seems to agree with him. Many Reform congregations now worship with Talesim and Kippot, and all have many more rituals than they had some years ago. Look at our congregation. Consecration, Bar Mitzvah, Bat Mitzvah, Havdalah, Third Sabbath, and the like, all post-World War II additions to temple life. I have no trouble with the color or the ritualization of Jewish life. I do have trouble with the assumption that it is an Orthodox norm which is the standard for all things Jewish. Reform Judaism was not and is not simply a cutback of tradition. It is a reformulation of the old traditions to include new concepts of family, of women as equals, of the appropriateness of biblical criticism, and of many of, and of the thinking which has to do with progressive revelation. We do not accept that rabbinic law is the be-all and end-all, though we accept many of its structures. We speak of progressive revelation as given to the seers of ancient generations and those of our own day. We speak of women and equality in ways which are quite different from Talmudic Orthodox Judaism. We can take that subject, women and equality, as an example of our differences. In Talmudic Judaism, a woman may not offer testimony in court. She has no place in the organization of synagogue business. She is governed by a series of potentially cruel laws, such as the law regarding the aguna, the deserted wife. There are today 7,000 agunot, deserted wives, in Israel. Either husbands are presumed dead, but have died without a witness to their death, or their husbands have refused to issue their wives a get, a bill of divorce. Orthodox Judaism decrees that only a man may issue a get. A woman may not. Now, the rabbis have recognized for years that injustice is possible in this situation, but they have been unable to correct it. We simply and tragically have in Israel 7,000 women who cannot remarry, and an association of women who call themselves prisoners of the rabbinic court. Most in the diaspora, particularly in the American diaspora, are unaware of how much they are touched by this spread of traditionalism, but it colors their thinking and attracts some of the young who find the reform and conservative ways too amorphous or too vague. The issue is not whether or not American Jews, with their liberalism and their self-assertion and their freedom, can understand how the good and valid, taken from a 1,500-year-old rich tradition, can be absorbed and sublimated into a way of life that is modern and meaningful. 20 or 50 years ago, Judaism represented to most American Jews a social gospel, a vision of the future, a tradition acceptable up to a point. Today, Judaism represents to the American Jew a social gospel, a vision of the future, a tradition which they probably ought to accept, but do not. How to break through this impasse is the challenge, and it requires more knowledge and thought than most I seem ready to and prepared to give. The changing Jew. In America, there are many elements that make up this pattern. A generation ago, college boards were heavily Jewish in their honors. Today, they are heavily Oriental. Today, there is a much smaller group of Jewish children passing through the classroom. Jews have worked hard and done well. We represent the single most successful community in America. We are also an aging community. Our median age is nearly 40, the oldest in America. What will the results be of outmarriage for us? What will the high rate of delayed marriage mean for us? And such questions. The average American Jew is well-educated, liberal, sophisticated, but religiously naive. He needs to progress from a view which emphasizes traditional color and ritual to one which includes a careful assessment of the values of the past and the present. We need to recapture some of the rich spirit of reform, its willingness to experiment, to change, to develop. We need to remind ourselves that Judaism is not a past, but a present and a future. And the present and the future depend upon a moral and ethical understanding of the issues of the past, quite as much as they do on the tradition itself. Amen.